I am 27, the 29th of April, 1980, to the 28th of April, 1981. Over.
Nothing's quite adding up. By Al Gore. The door to my office slammed open. Boss must have a case for me. Drummond, I got a case for you. Seems some big players have been turning up dead, and word on the street is there might be some foul play involved. First couple of stiffs we've linked are laid out in this file. We need you to chase this up. Figure out who's behind this and why. Do good on this one, and maybe I'll put in a good word for you with the boys up in A&R. Great. I thumbed through the paltry sheaf of papers he tossed onto my desk. First croaker, Bon Scott of AC/DC, back in February. Nothing immediately suspicious about the circumstances. All evidence pointed to your standard rager gone wrong. Next page, one Tommy Caldwell, car accident. Bassist for some US rock group. Never heard of the guy. But one of the cars involved reminded me of a buddy of mine. An Aussie and a Yank. Both died in cars, but otherwise no obvious connection. Still, if the boss says they're linked, they must be linked. Time to get to work. Monday, 19th of May, 1980, 3 a.m. 3 weeks of false leads and dead ends, and now finally a break. Just a shame it had to come like this. Got word of the suicide around lunchtime, and something about it immediately set alarm bells ringing. By a stroke of luck, this one was local, relatively speaking. So I grabbed a sandwich to go and hopped onto the 1:30 to Cheshire. The corpse's missus was still there, and I managed to sweet-talk her into letting me take a look around. The official word was that the corpse had self-inflicted, and I didn't know what exactly I was looking for. Kitchen looked like you'd expect. Plates left in the sink, half-eaten fruit. Turned to the body, and there it was, a small patch shaved away on the side of his head, in the shape of a star, and a light dusting of trimmings on top of the rope. This had happened after. Now that's a calling card, if ever I've seen one. But for who? In Surrey, now chasing up another lead, just stopped at a 24-hour diner after passing a nasty crash on the A3. Looks like someone flipped their car, avoiding a lorry. Local peelers were already there. Hope whoever it was made it out all right. Saturday, the 2nd of August, 1980. 2 p.m. Still working the case. Things have been quiet. No more apparent victims. But I get the feeling this guy's like an earthquake. The longer the calm, the more likely he is to strike. Been taking advantage of the lull to focus on the more mundane parts of the job. Bunny's album is selling all right. Can't remember what we ended up calling it. Alligator or something. Hope a bit of success doesn't put anyone in my corner in a bad spot. Heard the Eagles had a rough show the other night and might be throwing in the towel. Fortunately, seems like a bloodless affair. Doubt our guys involved, since murder is a big part of this M.O. Might be good to keep our ear out nonetheless. Friday, the 26th of September, 1980. 12 p.m. Another one bites the dust. Toxicology just came back for Bonham. He'd been drinking. All right, but that's not what did him in. Docs found traces of hydrogen cyanide. A clear-cut case of poisoning. Something about the choice of poison strikes me. Some bit of trivia turned important, but I can't quite place it. The trail had gone dead for months, and I was beginning to wonder if these deaths weren't even linked after all. But clearly our man is still out there, and only getting cockier. Boss has stopped yelling at me and moved down the checklist to cold glares. Never a good sign. I've got to figure out who this guy is, what he wants, and fast. Tuesday, the 2nd of December, 1980, 12 a.m. Feels like that I'm on the verge of a breakthrough, but it just won't come. Connect two dots and another gets blocked off. Nothing's quite adding up. At this point, I can't even be sure which bands our guy is killing and which are dying from natural causes. Truth be told, managing bands is enough work without having to worry about some psycho assassinating them. Starting to feel like maybe I'm not cut out for this business after all. Thursday, the 9th of December, 1980, 7 a.m. Caught the news tonight. Oh boy, now all comes into focus. The sickening swirl of disparate clues made clear. They say they've got the guy who did it, but I know the truth. I know who must have put him up to it. Only problem is, no way the boss is going to let me go after him. He's too protected. First thing I did was pull the autopsy report for Scott. Hadn't seemed important at the time, but there it was, clear as day, stomach contents, copious amounts of liquor, and a partially digestive Granny Smith, Caldwell. They had found a pair of drumsticks in his Jeep's glove compartment. Little weird for a guy who played bass. And Bonham? Well, turns out that cyanide poisoning was actually an amygdalin overdose. Apple seeds. I picked up a bit of Japanese a couple of years back with one of my bands. Haven't forgotten their word for apples. I still don't know when this all started or why he'd turn on his own band now. Maybe Lennon would have been safe if he'd stayed out of the biz. Or if I could have put the puzzle together sooner. No way to know now. You know, as much as I love a good conspiracy, I never really bought into all the Paul is dead nonsense. Why cover up? Now I'm beginning to wonder. Tuesday, the 28th of April, 1981, 8 a.m. Just got an anonymous tip that Wings are breaking up. He must be tying up loose ends. I've got to warn George.
Under. The Third Person Speaks by Sean Mehmet. From the 29th of April 1980 until the 28th of April 1981, the future elderly gentleman was 27 years old. The following paragraphs will duly attest to the fact that, unlike Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Amy Winehouse et al., he did not drop his body, to quote Genesis Briar P. Orridge, and shuffle off to another plane of mortal existence. Nor, much to his chagrin, was he a first draft pick for Scotland's The Queen of the South football team. Nor was he single-handedly responsible for Julian Cope's premature demise. nor was he able to pen any publications at all as Tenzing Scott Brown, lugubriously switching over to the affirmative for a moment. On the very first day of turning 27, Bill Drummond found himself with his head firmly buried in his hands. And why exactly was he suffering such angst, one might well wonder? Had he and a musical friend just set fire to a large amount of legal tender? Was he dolefully depressed at having overly indulged in tequila shooters the night before at Eric's? Was his questioning his moral turpitude vis-a-vis his ongoing participation in the largely corrupt Liverpudlian music biz of the very early 80s? Was he enduring an epistemological crisis, one that slowly derived from Ian McCulloch's lyrics to The Killing Moon? No, dear listener, the underpinning reason for Bill's unfortunate malaise on the 29th of April 1980 had less to do with a purely Western worldview and more to do with an Eastern one. A Far Eastern one. Yes, truth be told, Bill Drummond's mental quagmire stemmed from a question he had about a specific novel by the Japanese writer Tanizaki Junichiro. The specific novel that was causing Bill such anguish and consternation was entitled, at least in its English language translation, Some Prefer Nettles. However, the original Japanese title of this novel was literally Water Pepper-Eating Bugs, and is the first half of the Japanese saying Tadiku Mushi Mu Sukizuki, or Water Pepper-Eating Bugs Eat It Willingly. This, as any Japanese-to-English translator will assert, is roughly equivalent to the English phrase, each to his own. So, for the life of him, young Bill could simply not fathom what was the connection between water pepper-eating bugs and the subjective preference for a herbaceous plant which has jagged leaves covered with stinging hairs. Now, there's a hackneyed old aphorism which posits that time heals all wounds. Suffice to say that by midsummer of 1980, Bill was no longer so distraught over the ontological similarities and differences between water pepper-consuming aphids and herbaceous nettles. In fact, Bill was now fully and completely occupied with a uniquely American culinary delicacy called Betty Crocker's pudding roll-ups. As things transpired, Bill seemed to vaguely recall that these opaque blobs of custard ensconced in plastic had, in fact, been preceded, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, by something called Betty Crocker's fruit roll-ups, which, our protagonist vividly imagined, were quite possibly bits of dried fruit wrapped around a skewer. But try as he might, young Bill was categorically and dismally unable to come up with any sort of halfway decent mental image of rolled-up pudding wrapped in plastic. Be that as it may, let us now hop right into our stainless steel Canadian-made DeLorean Motor Company time machine and fast forward slightly more than 3.5 decades. Yes, dear reader, an article in The Onion details the 2016 travails of a Kentucky grandmother named Edna Lee. Apparently, Grandmother Lee was in a desperate need to feed her 12-year-old grandson and retrieved a dusty, faded box of Betty Crocker brand pudding roll-ups from the darkest recesses of her kitchen cupboard. Of course, at this stage of these Bill Drummond's memoirs, we find our protagonist innocently wondering what on earth happened to this unnamed 12-year-old boy after he digested these slightly past their prime Betty Crocker morsels. And at this particular stage of the Bill Drummond biographical narrative, we also find 27-year-old Bill metaphysically pondering just what kind of a culinary artist Betty Crocker might have been. Apart from unleashing rolled-up pudding on an unsuspecting American public, what exactly were her particular hobbies or interests? Did she collect Malaysian butterflies? Did she appreciate the percussive sounds of Indonesian gamelan? Was she into big game hunting? And here's a fun fact. Betty Crocker actually appeared for several years on the syndicated US television show The George Burns and Gracie Allen Show. For a while, she even had her own TV show, Betty Crocker Star Matinee. If 27-year-old Bill Drummond had had his very own syndicated American TV show, dear listener, just what kind of content would it have had? Bears on bicycles, Julian Cope juggling, an aged and bespectacled theologian explaining the true meaning of the Book of Revelation, the one and only apocalyptic book in the entire New Testament. And, speaking of the apocalypse, in very late April 1981, was there any way at all that our main man, Bill D., could possibly have predicted the doom and gloom that was about to land smack dab on his doorstep right after his 28th birthday? I mean, people say all the time that truth is stranger than fiction, but the convoluted and arteriosclerotic sequence of events that was about to engulf our beloved future elderly gentleman at the outset of his 28th year really and plainly was beyond the proverbial pale, so to speak.
A Troubled Dream. The Bus by Nick Anderson. Once again, I've woken up in a pool of sweat. Damn, the bus dreams have returned. The number 23 double-decker buses have been a near constant part of my dreams for these last 8 months. The bus trips that return at least a few times a week, and unlike real buses, they seem to be getting more frequent. The people on the buses, usually, are all people from my personal past, or even some people that I have never even met. I mean, last night, Johnny Depp was on the top deck with me. During some of these dreams, it can be just a mix of people that I've met in my recent past. Normally on these trips, the bus either has some kind of small accident, where no one actually gets hurt, or I get on to find the people on the lower deck of the bus are painting some of my paintings. These type of paintings, which I can only describe as my dream paintings, isn't my usual type of painting. But I suppose that's dreams and my dream's interpretation of paintings for you. On this occasion, I'm on a bus while it's driving around the streets of the city of Aberdeen, of all places. I've no idea why it's Aberdeen, but it is. I think that each bus trip feels a little like Groundhog Day. In this dream, I've been standing waiting for the bus at the normal bus stop that my dream state mind always goes back to. I get on, pay the driver, and it drives around Aberdeen, or at least the areas of Aberdeen that my subconscious dream state mind has made up. As in reality, I've no idea what these areas of Aberdeen look like. On this dream bus trip occasion, I climb the stairs to the upper deck of the bus, where I find Echo and the Bunnymen are busy sound checking. Pete, who is another part of my recurring dream, banging a beat on the drums, while Mac is busy warming up. I look around, nod, say hello. I can't help but think that the top deck of a bus really isn't the place for doing sound checks. Ding ding! My stop then approaches, and once again I get off my dream bus. This dream bus trip, just about to become one of many I will try and forget when awake. Just one more dream scenario my subconscious dream state mind has randomly picked. I disembark the bus, and then I wake up. There really is no sense to these dream bus trips, but as always, they seem to be forever in my dreams. Postscript. I was going to pen a short poem about a cow on a bus, but it got off before I had a chance to write about it. Asterix. And why the fuck Johnny Depp? I mean, he means nothing to me, other than the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I don't think I've ever seen him in any other film.